are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Question Reality. I am Priscilla Leona, and we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now, if this is your first time tuning in, you are going to love this show, because if you're questioning your reality, we are going to help you. We're going to help you tune in and figure out if you're pursuing the right career. This show is for you if you were, are, or might be considering a career in show business. We have various guests that work in the entertainment industry, and their goal is to inspire, motivate, and educate people who wish to follow their dream by pursuing a career in show business. So we will have people from all different professions on this show, so you have to tune in every week or go to our website to find out who is coming on next week. The official website is questionrealityradioshow.com, questionrealityradioshow.com, and that's the website where you can find out who is coming on for the rest of the year. Now, if you want to listen to any of our past shows, download any of the shows, you can go to the Question Reality website archive page, which is latalkradio.com, latalkradio.com, and you can find us on the schedule for Sundays at 5 o'clock. And we also broadcast on iTunes and Stitcher.com. So our shows are spreading across the world via iTunes. And now we've been on since 2008, and we're just so fortunate that the show's become very popular. And we have people on that are just loving what we're doing. They're very supportive. And we usually do have people on in the entertainment industry, but this particular week, our focus is on a volunteer organization, a nonprofit organization. So today we have a very, very, very special guest. She was referred to me by a very good friend of mine named Christina DeRosa. Her name is Kelly Gonzalez, and she is the executive director of the Mulligan Project. And if you want to go there right now and check it out, it's themulliganproject.org, themulliganproject.org. That's themulliganproject.org. You can also find them on Twitter at Mulligan Project and Facebook at Mulligan Project too. Mulligan Project. Facebook.com Mulligan Project. Yay. Okay. So we're going to be asking lots and lots of questions today that people may have if they're pursuing a career in a nonprofit organization, such as maybe what are some clues that you might be a good fit for a career in a nonprofit organization. What characteristic traits do you definitely need to possess if you want to work successfully in a nonprofit organization? And what can one do to follow their dream working in a nonprofit, but at the same time working on being financially secure for their retirement? A lot of people fear going into nonprofit jobs because of the, I guess, what they feel is a lack of profitability for them. So we're going to find out more about that from Kelly. Now, if you don't already know about the Mulligan Project, it is a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of children with disabilities in Central Vietnam, and they provide special education, physical therapy, and healthcare services to the underserved and the overlooked generation of vulnerable children. So Kelly Gonzalez is here today. She is just a wonderful woman, from what I hear from Christina DeRosa. Now, she is the executive director of the Mulligan Project, and she and her husband, Eddie I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right. She's going to kill me if I'm not. Rowetter in 2000. Is it Rowetter?
Rowetter, yeah.
Yes, I got it. Yes. They founded the Mulligan Project in 2009. When Kelly traveled to Vietnam, though, in late 2008, and she found that her life was forever changed by the amazing children of the Hoi An Orphanage. And she was so moved by the experience, and in particular, a little girl named Hong, that Kelly went back to Vietnam 3 months later. And this time she wanted to learn more about the children and the, I believe, Kion Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a UK nonprofit on, on the ground in Vietnam that's been pioneering a better life for children with disabilities in Central Vietnam. And then a month later, Kelly and Eddie were honored when the Kion Foundation asked them to be partners in their endeavor to help the children. So they gladly accepted and created the Mulligan Project. And again, the Mulligan Project is a U.S.-based nonprofit dedicated to the same mission. So without further ado, welcome Kelly Gonzalez.
Hi, Priscilla. How are you?
I'm just doing so fine now that we got over the scare of my computer dying.
Yeah, we're all good now.
Yeah. So, first of all, I wanted to thank you so much for being on the show. Kelly.
Thank you.
Christina DeRosa. How do you know our lovely Christina DeRosa, first of all?
Yeah, Christina is amazing. She actually came to our annual gala last year in September. Every September, we have the Mid-Autumn Festival, and it's our big gala. And she was one of our guests there, and she was fortunate enough to hear about it, which is great, and came and listened. And I was so lucky that she wanted to sponsor a child at the end of the event, which is always our goal. And Christina's been sponsoring a little boy at the school that we run since October of last year. And I just visited there, so he's doing really well. And Christina and I have been in touch ever since, so I would like to give her updates on the child that she sponsored.
Isn't that fantastic? Wow. Yeah, she's definitely a philanthropist. She's always trying to help and support everyone. She's a wonderful, wonderful person in that respect.
Yeah, she definitely has it.
I was so happy when she referred your organization, because I do have a love of Vietnam. Two past Vietnamese
really?
Friends, but that's not the only reason. They were lovely, and their feet were like petals, but that's beside the story. Just a lovely culture, because I did get to know about Vietnam through the two past Vietnamese boyfriends, and the culture and the food and the way they are, and they were just so
great.
And loving and welcoming. And so I learned so much about Vietnam. And I also had a fascination because my father was in Vietnam, and he died in Vietnam. And so I've always had, I've always had like that fascination with Vietnam. So it was very, very fortuitous for me to meet these two young boys, and for me to learn about Vietnam through them. I got to hang out in Westchester, which I believe is Little Saigon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't still, because this was the early 90s. And that it's a huge Vietnamese population in Southern California. And
right.
If you do like or interested in something other than going to Chinatown or Little Tokyo, which is in downtown LA,
yeah.
There is a whole culture, a Vietnamese culture in Westchester, which I'm not sure if you went, you've gone, or I mean.
Yeah, I've been many times. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's actually the largest population of Vietnamese people living outside of Vietnam. Down in Orange County there. So it's, and the food I have found to be, on the most part, very, very true to what you would find in Vietnam. So if any foodies are out there listening as well, it's a good destination place just in terms of the food alone.
That is true, because a lot of times here, like if you go to Chinatown or Little Tokyo, and again, I've never been to China or Japan, but I do have Chinese and Japanese friends, and what they tell me is that the food is so, so, so different here than it is.
Yeah.
China and Japan. But I have heard that before, where my boyfriends have told me, yes, the food in Little Saigon, Westchester, is almost identical to the food in Vietnam. I was about to say Saigon in Vietnam. So
mm-hmm.
the closest you're going to get. So I, being a foodie, I'm glad you brought that for sure. Now, let's go back a little bit, Kelly. Let's go back to when little Kelly Gonzalez was a child. Everybody dreams of I wanted to be Wonder Woman. Somebody wants to be something, right? So when you were a child, what did you dream about doing as your career? Because we're going to talk about what you started out doing and what you ended up doing, which I think is very, very important, because so many people say, God, you know, I started out dreaming I wanted to do this, but now I'm doing this. And some people are kind of happy about it, which they should be because they've just changed. But then some people get a little bummed out. They say, I haven't followed through with my dreams. So, you know, let's mm-hmm. talk about, what did you want to do?
Well, the first thing I remember wanting to do, a specific role, I'd always loved television and was addicted to TV, but the first thing I could think of was I wanted to be a director. That was probably, I think I was in high school at that time. First it was director. It was always related around television. I think first was director. I used to like videotaping or taping or recording the, it was actually Facts of Life, that I would tape it and play each shot back and try to memorize how the director, you know, from a two shot to a one. Loved doing that. Then I wanted to be the president of NBC at one point. But it was always, that was with Brandon Tartikoff years. That was a real passion of mine for a while, but I knew it was always going to be working in television.
And then you went to work in television as a producer for
Correct,
some.
Yeah.
Tell
yeah.
us about
so I'm from a, sorry, go ahead.
Tell us about that experience.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. I'm from Louisiana, but when I was 18, I came out to Pepperdine for college. Graduated in 94, got incredibly fortunate, got my foot in the door, and started off as a receptionist on a sitcom. And
Which one? I have to know.
It only aired three times, so I'm sure you're not going to remember it, but it was the first thing Carrie Russell was on. It was a sitcom on CBS called Daddy's Girls. But I was fortunate enough to be working for a company called Whit Thomas, and they had just finished production on The Golden Girls. So they do Blossom, they did the John Larroquette Show, a lot of big hits. So I was fortunate to get in with that company, and they kept me around as long as they were around. So I was with Whit Thomas for about 4 years. Then I went off and did some reality shows, did a drama at one point, and then switched over to a game show called Deal or No Deal, and I did that the last 4 years of my television career. So the TV career lasted about 15, 16 years.
Oh, yeah, because I was about to say, in 4 years, you made it from receptionist to producer? How did that happen?
No, 4 years, I was probably production coordinator or manager at that point. Then I was able to jump to line producer. So that's where my career ended there with television. And when I was a line producer, that's when I started traveling to third world countries and got this insatiable, you know, itch really for helping people.
Well, let me ask you, let's go back to the producer of the television. Yeah. How, in your professional opinion, how did you work your way from receptionist all the way up to television producer? What do you feel you needed to do to be able to make that? Because that's in 15 years, that's pretty progressive, I think. That's a really good leap. So how did you do that? What did you feel was the same?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and like any job, is being able to handle multiple personalities and staying calm about it. So, and I think that translates to TV and beyond, and so to many different careers. So being able to handle different people and their personalities, and always make them understand that you're the one listening and that you can help them, that you're not the enemy, but still being firm. It's a delicate balance, you know, somewhere between heart and head, and knowing you've got to get the job done. And for me also too, I ended up more on the budget side of things and the, hiring of the crew and the staff. So, it's really about building a team and being a team leader.
Now, for those who don't know out there, I guess at the height of your career as a producer on television, you said you were a line producer. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So for those who don't know what a line producer does, tell us what a line producer does in television.
It's the not fun part of producing. It's the non-creative version. which is you get to see everybody else come up with these great ideas and they fulfill them on TV, but you come up with the budget for it.
Hey, so without you, there can't be creative happening. You're creative with the budgeting now.
Sometimes you have to be. Yeah, you wouldn't believe how much creativity sometimes needs to go into that.
Like, what would be for you as a line producer?
Sorry, what was the first part?
What would be an average day of duties as a line producer for television?
Depends on if we're taping that day or not. If we're not taping, then it's listening to what are the ideas coming up for the next episode. Are they requesting a hot air balloon in the Serengeti, or, you know, Thai elephants, or is it just any generic park, which is going to be cheap? So it's a lot of listening to what the producers are coming up with and, you know, kind of gauging, all right, how much is that going to cost, even though it may not be a reality yet. And trying to stay not ahead of them, but at least on alongside of them, so that you're not caught off guard the day before you're shooting and you say, what? I didn't know you needed animals in this show. So it's
they really very well can dream up in the middle of the night and then want it the next day. So,
yes, you have to be ready. have to figure out a way to get it and cheaply.
Yeah. So what did you love most about your job as a line producer, and what did you like least?
Least would definitely be the hours, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm leading with least, but,
that's,
you know,
true.
Especially during a tape week or month, or if you're on a drama, it feels endless. The hours, because you end up having almost no life when, you know, if you're in the middle of taping. And the thing that I love the most really were working with the people.
Yeah.
You could be on the biggest show, and if the cast and crew that you're working with are all a bunch of jerks, it doesn't matter. It's not going to make you happy. And then you could be working on the lowest rated show, but if the team around you is supportive and energetic and positive, and, you know, they become friends for life, that's the part that I really like the most. So any of those shows with the negative energy is not worth it.
Yeah, it does seem like that's the consensus across the board. The hours are the worst, because I don't think when people watch television shows, they have any idea how long the hours are. When you see a show, you may see a couple seconds of a scene, but that scene could have taken hours and hours to make, like 50 takes. You never know.
Absolutely.
That like 14, 15, 16, 17 hours. There's even such a thing called golden time, and that's a whole different situation.
I know that well.
You didn't like golden time, because that's when you pay. Now, actors love golden time sometimes, because you make a lot of money. That's when you make
the crew as well. I mean, it's like going to a casino and, you know, hitting the jackpot when you get golden time.
And that doesn't bode well for the studios, that's for sure. They don't.
Yeah, I know. No. I used to have to sign the time card, so I would always cringe at that. Like,
my God. Now, to finish up on this particular topic, what were some of the shows that you worked on besides Deal or No Deal?
Yeah, well, before that, I worked 4 years on the show Ripley's Believe It or Not, the one where Dean Cain was the host. Yeah.
Oh, my God, bet you love that. He is a hottie. Woo! Okay, we'll pass on that.
He is, and he was a nice guy to work with. And that show is actually where I met my future husband. So that one has a special place in my heart.
Good memories from that. What was he doing on the show? Was he working on it?
Yeah, he was a senior producer at the time on that show.
Okay. All right. Oh, boy. That was nice. Oh, love it. Okay. So what other shows did you work on? Because I watched that. I just want to find out what shows you worked on that I watched.
Sure. I also did a drama. It was one of those Saturday syndicated dramas. It was called Air America, and that was with Lorenzo Lamas.
My God. You have been so lucky. Look at that D-Pain, Lorenzo Lamas. These little babes. Did you specifically choose these projects, Kelly Gonzalez?
Oh, no. You'd think I did, but no, I came on long after they were cast.
Yeah, I remember that. And what else did you work on?
Speaking of Line of Hunks, I also worked on a sitcom at Warner Brothers with Scott Baio. So, don't know how old you are, but...
Charles in Charge?
Yes, exactly. I had a crush on him.
Oh, my God. Oh, are you kidding? I ran into him, me and my girlfriends, when I was single. We ran into him at the Brown Derby up on The Derby. No, not the Brown Derby. The Derby. It was this.
In Los Feliz.
Yeah, on Los Feliz. Yeah, and you know, he was like hitting on us all drunk and slopped up, but he's such a nice guy, though. He's such a sweetheart. He really is. But he gets a little carried away, and he's like, in his mind, in his little drunken mind, he was like, oh, I've got to be macho because I'm Chachi. But then he went back to guest speak Scott Baio, which is a super nice, really nice, gentlemanly type guy. So yeah, that was my Scott Baio experience. But yeah.
And
a friend of mine did a music video with him recently. So yeah, that was a nice show. Yeah. Josie Davis is having a pretty good career on Lifetime. I didn't even recognize her when she grew up. She was like, you know, remember her?
Right. Sorry, that took me a second.
I know. The name always was like Josie Davis, and I had to think about it. But yeah, she was. She just did a Lifetime movie where she played this psychopath surrogate. She was excellent. She's a really talented actress. She really is. And Nicole Eckert, I think, is now on Splash.
Splash, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. God bless her. Okay. So what prompted you? You're living what most people would call the life. I mean, most people would die to have the career that you have. All of a sudden, what prompted you to change careers? What happened to you that all of a sudden you said, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore? What happened?
Yeah. Well, one night I was reading Vanity Fair. My friend had an extra copy and she said, hey, do you want this? I've never read Vanity Fair before. I was flipping through it and I saw an article about the Nightwalkers of Uganda. And it was just shocking to me. It was an article about the war in northern Uganda with the LRA and Joseph Kony. And now everyone, it's pretty much common knowledge because of the great work that, the nonprofit in San Diego has been doing with the Kony campaign. Everyone's aware of Northern Uganda now, but at the time in 2007, I was reading this in 2005, I had never heard of this war and hundreds of thousands of children being tortured and maimed, having their ears cut off, their nose, forced to shoot their mother in front of the other children, being taken as child soldiers. I have never heard of a war specifically aimed at children. And so I finished reading the article. I turn on the news, and I think the news had something about, you know, what restaurant Britney Spears was at that night. And it just shook me that, why don't I know about what I just read? Why aren't you covering what's obviously so much more important? How come everyone I've spoken to has never heard of this? But I know where Britney Spears went to dinner tonight. And it bugged me. And so I started asking around. Like I said, a lot of people, have you heard of this war? And I finally found one person at work who said, yes, I know all about it. And you should find out more. And so I contacted the person who wrote that article, found out more about the war, the issues, how long it had been going on, more definitely about Joseph Kony. And I knew that at that point that I had to go to Uganda. I didn't know why. I didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew I had to go. And I couldn't stop daydreaming about it. So a couple of years later, I had a break in work, and I'd done enough research where I felt comfortable to go on my own. And I ended up doing a volunteer vacation in southern Uganda with elementary schools. But I really wanted to go to northern Uganda. And I was fortunate enough to meet an accidental meeting with the niece of the president of the country, who said, I will put you on a bus, you will go to northern Uganda, and you're going to work with invisible children and help the kids out at the IDP camps, which are also known as refugee camps. It's slightly different. And I stayed there for 3 weeks and worked with invisible children, and that's really where, you know, I walked through my first refugee camp and worked with my first nonprofit, and I found out the things that I liked about it as a nonprofit and the things I didn't like. So, I knew that I left my heart in Uganda at that point.
Instead of San Francisco, it was in Uganda. I like that. There needs to be a song involved there. What did you initially see that I was just curious, what were the things that you saw that you liked about a nonprofit that were positive and the things that were not positive about a nonprofit overall in general?
Yeah, overall. Well, I really, I mean, the thing that I liked the most about it was how much they were genuinely helping the people. You could see it. You could touch it. They were helping the women get back on their feet and have an income. They created a checking account for every woman that they would save money for them. And these women would make bracelets, and they would sell the bracelets. And they really taught them financial responsibility and gave them opportunity. And they worked hard making these bracelets out of telephone wire. And they're beautiful. So I appreciated the opportunities that they gave the people, the support, but also, too, with the huge sensitivity to that culture and not trying to change anything. It's just providing opportunity and knowledge, but not, you know, not a third leg. So that's the thing that I really appreciated about that was how much they were supplementing, because the World Food Program would come into the refugee camp on the first of every month with a few bags of rice, and by a week it was gone.
Mm.
So these women needed to learn how to sustain themselves and their family.
Mm.
It's typically in that environment, a lot of the men will find ways to make moonshine and kind of check out. So a lot of the burden for the family definitely relies on the women. So that's really who they focused on, as that is true in many third world countries. So I appreciated the knowledge that they gave me and the resources that they gave these women to be able to help themselves outside of a refugee camp. Because obviously they're not living there now. So they still have those skills no one can take away from them.
Mm.
And the things that I like the least about any nonprofit is the overhead and things that I just don't think are should be necessary.
as an executive director for a nonprofit organization, again, overall in general, what
mm-hmm.
are the general duties and responsibilities?
For me, for an executive director, we have it's myself and an intern from Pepperdine. Those are the two of us in the office, and then we have a working board. So I don't have a big staff like, say, World Vision, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot more of the responsibility falls on the two of us. So it's not only determining what the vision of the organization is and running that through the board, but also running everything the day-to-day as well, planning all the events. And also doing budgets, which comes back to my previous skill. That's really important.
Mm-hmm.
The courting of board members is a big part of it. And also visiting the school and keeping in touch with our sister charity, the Keon Foundation, because I always like to get updates on the kids and being on the same page with them. So it's really, for me, it's a very big umbrella.
Yeah,
it's the PR person, it's the... the budget person, it's the hiring
it's
and firing.
It's the sales, the marketing, everything. It's just like me, a one-woman organization over here.
Yeah, social media, anything.
Yeah. Right. So what do you feel would be some clues that you may be a good fit for a career in a nonprofit organization? Because it is not for everyone. It is definitely not. You really have to have some basic characteristic traits. What do you feel? If somebody's mm-hmm. thinking, you know what, I think I might want to work in nonprofit because I want to give more of myself, but they're leery about something, what would be some clues that you think that they should at least try it?
Right. Well, I think in a way, it's like any career where if you have the heart and the passion for it and you can't stop thinking about it, go for it, try it. I'm not saying, quit your day job, but I think like any good career, the foundation has to be a huge passion for it. And then within that, once you know you've got that and you can't stop thinking about it, the nice thing about nonprofits is it's so broad that if you have any skill from a previous job, whether it be accounting or, an MBA, for me, budgets, people skills, anything like that, there's so many different areas of nonprofits. I bet you almost anyone could find a link to how they could help a nonprofit.
Absolutely. And I would think that some of the basic characteristic traits definitely is patience, flexibility.
Yes.
I think that you really have to have a sensitivity, compassionate. These are things I think are the base soup for the job, because you
right.
cannot be worried about, oh my God, where am I going to get, money for my JAG? Because if you have a JAG, you're going to end up selling it, hopefully. But you can't be worried
right.
about money. You do have to have, another thing that's very important to know is that you have to have some sort of financial support system, because, I mean, I'm not, again, an expert, but I do think that a lot of people are hesitant about going into a nonprofit organization because they don't know what they can do. They want to follow their dream career working in a nonprofit, but at the same time, they want to have retirement. They want to have money for retirement, and their fear is that they're not going to make a lot of money working in nonprofit. So what advice can you give someone who can work in a nonprofit, but at the same time, work on being financially secure for retirement? What can they do, or is it possible at all?
Well, the first thing I would say, if you want to find out more about nonprofits, and if you're fit before giving up that, you know, the other
cushy
career,
job.
The JAG and all that, the first thing I would do is I would get active. I would volunteer for a lot of nonprofits, and I would also try to get on the board for a nonprofit so that you see how the inner workings are. Because some of the ones, it's like anything, it's like a house or a person. You may volunteer for them and love what you did and the people around it, but then when you find out what's inside in the board, all the secrets and things like that, you may not like it. It may not be for you. So I would suggest trying to volunteer, get on a board. And then for me, it really depends on what your passion is, if it's animals, environment, children. But for me, the biggest change and motivator was travel. Uganda was my first third world country, and my life changed after that. Nothing was the same. So if you've got some hiatus time from all that, you know, the entertainment work, I would use it wisely, and I would open up your eyes and skip that European trip to cafes and museums, and I would go to a third world country and see how lucky we really are.
That is really a great suggestion. Now, it seems as though those who are most successful in making the transition from profit to nonprofit, foreign-related positions, are the people who understand that they're leaving one culture for another, and they're ready to make a commitment to make a difference. Was it an easy transition for you and your family, and if so, why?
No, I wouldn't say it was easy. I have a wonderful, amazing, supportive husband, so that part made it easy, and continues to make it as easy as it can be. But the first 2 years, it was really hard working alone when I was used to, you know, a 300-person office. So that part was strange. And then also to the, like you said before, you hit on the word patience. In TV, things happen very quickly. And within 24 hours, you could be doing anything. And with the world of nonprofits, it's very slow. And then when you throw in a third world country like a Uganda or Vietnam, it's incredibly slow. So patience was something that I really had to learn, and timing and not giving up, because it's very easy to have that flame at first, but it can't plateau and it can't die out. It's always got to be there. So you may hit some plateaus, but you've got to come back. So it was just riding it out like any career, but it was definitely a challenge in the beginning of feeling all alone. Like it's just me and I want to get this. I want it to be where I want it to be now.
Mm-hmm.
And learning how to have patience for it. Yeah. And the right temperament and changing my whole way of thinking. I, you know, I'm technically, I could take a salary, but I don't. So technically, I'm the executive director, but I'm also a volunteer, and so that means the way that I treat people is not the same when I'm hiring them for a television show, and I had to learn that. Everything I do is asking now.
Yeah, that is true. It's you have to have patience, yet you still have to have a little bit of a fire in your belly, because you do have to be passionate and exude that in order to follow through with getting the funds that you need to get for your organization. Your patience cannot be so, that cannot turn into a very, how do we say this, like a very low, a very like a personality where it's kind of like passive, or you're not passionate about, which a lot of people who are patient are often, I'm going to use the word misdiagnosed because I come from a medical family, they're misdiagnosed as to thinking that they lack passion, they lack interest, they lack fire for the project, but that's not necessarily the case. So you do have to have a balance with that, in anything that you're working on. So let's talk about Yeah, it's a transition. There are a lot of things to balance there. Now let's
talk
about...
I felt like I was really, I had to learn the difference between sprinting, like you do in TV, and now I'm running a marathon.
Exactly. So that's weird because in television, you know, you'd say everything is need it now, need it yesterday, go, 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 go. And then you got to have patience, I would imagine, for a nonprofit organization because it takes time. There are a lot of building blocks. So let's talk about what prompted your visit to Vietnam.
Right. So after I had traveled to Uganda, I knew at that point that I was no longer going to be doing, you know, your Western Europe, like I said, cafes and museum tour or the beaten path per se. And I loved doing volunteer work. That was so much more fulfilling to me than any beautiful sight that I could have seen. The people were fantastic. So I knew that I wanted to, and I also knew from Uganda that I had visited an orphanage there, and I loved the feeling of being able to put smiles on those kids' faces. So I went to Vietnam to do a volunteer vacation. I was actually, the only one I was assigned to was not with an orphanage, but I found one. I was assigned to do, to send mobile libraries to rural schools. And that was great. I did that for about a week in Hoi An, Vietnam, which is in central Vietnam. But while I was doing that volunteer vacation, I found a brochure for an orphanage with visiting hours. So I said, great, on the weekend, I'll go check that out and play with the kids. So I did that, but I had no idea that when I went there that I was walking into a room for severely disabled children. And so I walk in and I put my backpack down thinking that all these kids are going to rush me and I'll, you know, become this human jungle gym. We'll start crying. And not one kid got up to come play. And I just knew that there was something different in the air and I didn't know what it was. And there was one child who was having her bandages changed. In the corner, she actually had two heads and they were changing one of her bandages and she really should have been in a hospital, not an orphanage, but I don't have a very strong stomach for blood. So I had to take a deep breath. I had to actually go outside, take a deep breath and talk myself into going back into that room because I didn't know what was wrong with these kids, but something was wrong and it was going to be hard. I knew whatever was on the other side of that door. So, I talked myself into going back in because these kids had already locked eyes with me, even if they couldn't run up to me. And the last thing they needed was to build up some hope of being played with and then, you know, rejected once again. So I went back in and they pointed to a little girl for me to pick up. And I did. And I knew in that first laugh that she gave that she was also going to change my life. I didn't know how at the time, but there was something amazing about her that got under my skin. And I couldn't define it in the morning when I picked her up, but I could by that night. And that was to adopt her and bring her here and, you know, do all the love and care that I could for her. But I had to leave her that day, but she never really left me. And
was that the little girl Hong?
Yes, her name is Hong, and she's the one that moved me so much and that really changed everything in terms of shaping the rest of my life.
Now, tell us about the is it pronounced Keon Foundation?
The Keon, right, yeah.
Okay, so tell us about the Keon Foundation and how they helped you create the Mulligan Project.
Sure. The Keon Foundation, I later found out from this brochure that I had picked up, the Keon Foundation was a nonprofit that was helping the government orphanage where Hong lives and where she currently lives. It's called Hoi An Orphanage. The Keon Foundation was filling in the gaps of services that the government was not providing for these kids. In other words, they were providing some food and some shelter and caretakers, but these kids were really just rotting away. So the Keon Foundation created a nonprofit that gave the children special education, and they gave them physical therapy. They gave them health care, and even down to field trips, dental trips. They gave them birthday parties. They gave them the life that they deserved. And that was the mayor of the UK nonprofit. So when I found out they were the ones that were really helping Hong and all the other children to live the life I would want them to lead, to better their lives, to improve them, and really, basically it all comes down to the word dignity, to giving them the dignity that they deserve. I wanted to help that nonprofit in any way I could. And like I said, I've been exposed to many nonprofits at this point, and this was the only one I had found where I liked everything about them, between the way that they treated the children in the field and also the financial, because usually I find one or the other that I liked and another one I disliked. So about 6 months after I met them, I asked them, what more can we do? And they said, we've been looking for representation in the U.S. We don't have anyone to represent us in the U.S. Would you be willing to do it? And my husband and I said, absolutely.
Mm. From your perspective, what is the overall reality for the low-income families in Vietnam with respect to health care? Are there any health care programs available at all? Or
they're few and far between, and it mostly falls on the hardworking nonprofits that are, you know, providing those healthcare services. We had arranged two shunt surgeries for Hong, because she suffers from hydrocephalus. We provided a couple of, or arranged, obviously we don't do them ourselves. We arranged some heart surgeries for the children. And, you know, aside from that, if you are in Central Vietnam and your mom or dad make a dollar a day, the chances are you're not getting any healthcare services. The chances are you're not even brushing your teeth. So that's the primary thing that we do focus on, is making sure that the kids are as healthy as they can be, and then from there, building up their education and their physical therapy.
Is the health care and social programs better in North Vietnam and South Vietnam, and it's only Central Vietnam that's suffering?
Well, what I would say, like, similar to America, where you've got Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, north and south, they're huge cities, so they attract a lot of nonprofits. The thing that I like working in Central Vietnam is it's where the need is the greatest. In the province where we work, there's over 1,000 children with disabilities and maybe 2 services for them. And it's a very poor rural community. So again, the parents are making probably a dollar a day. Even those 2 services, you're not really going to be able to afford. And everything that we do is free for the children. So it's kind of like if a bomb went off in Missouri, but all the nonprofits are in LA and New York, you need to come to Missouri. So that's where we focus on, where I think there may be, you know, 10 really big active nonprofits in Central Vietnam. But you get to the north and south, and there's hundreds, not thousands.
Wow. Now, how is the cooperation with the government officials in Vietnam? Are they open to more people coming in with starting nonprofits, or is that a big hassle? Or
right. It definitely is still a big hassle, and this is where I give all the credit to the co-founder of the Keon Foundation. I'm glad she paved the way for me for this, because I don't think I would have had the patience. I think I would have been kicked out of the country. it took her 2 years of talking to officials, 2 years going there every day, learning Vietnamese, getting their trust, because, you know, and the first she said, I want to help these children, and they said, why? What's in it for you?
Oh, my God.
Building up that trust in the beginning is crucial with the People's Committee. And I, like I said, I will always bow down to her for being able to do that, because I think I would have been out in 3 months.
Absolutely. I heard it is very, yeah, very hard. I've known people who've wanted to start nonprofits in foreign countries, specifically, again, Vietnam, and they said it was such a hassle they gave up. One guy,
yeah,
5 years,
absolutely,
and he couldn't do it. So what was her secret?
Yeah.
I mean, what was her secret to finally getting it done?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing in reality, I think because she's an angel and she, God made her special. I don't know, because it takes an incredibly special person to be able, she was actually just on a vacation to Vietnam with a girlfriend. She's from Scotland, and the girlfriend worked in special education. She said, I want to go visit this orphanage. I hear it has, you know, special education programs. And my friend Jackie said, oh, that sounds depressing. I want to go to the beach. So the friend said, okay, let's just go for a little bit, and then we'll go to the beach. Well, they went to the orphanage. Obviously, they found out there were no special education programs. The kids were sitting in rotten cribs with buckets underneath them. And Jackie decided that day that she was not leaving. And she's been in Vietnam ever since. So she's gained a lot, but she's also given up a lot. And I think she's just cut from a different cloth. But the thing that was a real game changer for her was her showing up every single day and then finally learning Vietnamese.
Oh, that's a very hard language for sure.
Yes, it does.
I tried to learn that. I still only remember come on, which is thank you. Let's talk about funding. Before we go, we got 2 minutes. I want to make sure we get some funding for this project. I know that we can sponsor a child for $60 a month, which is
correct.
A small price. I mean, you spend more than that on your Starbucks coffee, people.
I was going to say that works out. It works out because it's Monday through Friday, obviously, for the kids in the school, and it works out to $3 a day, which, yes, is Starbucks.
And we can do that by going to the website, which is themullikinproject.org.
Correct.
Okay, so they can go there and they can donate directly right from the website.
Exactly. It's $60 a month to sponsor a child.
And that's to sponsor. Yeah, you can sponsor a child, or you take individual donations. So if somebody just wants to donate a lump sum, they can do that as well on the website.
Absolutely. Any amount, everything is welcome and appreciated. And you can also click on whether you would like it to be a one-time gift or recurring if you wanted to sponsor a child. Right now we have 45 children in the school, but we're able to fit 100. So our goal is to get to 100 by next year. So the more sponsorships, obviously, the more children we can have in our classrooms.
Absolutely. My gosh. And for you people who are concerned about this, not as you should be, I would imagine it's tax deductible, so you can write it off, correct? Now, your next fundraiser is coming up, which I found is very exciting. Your next fundraiser is Drag Queen Bingo on July 17th at 9
yes.
at Hamburger Mary's in West Hollywood. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is going to be our first time doing it, but I know a lot of nonprofits have been very successful with this, and I love it because it's different and fun. And, you know, my goal is not to give speeches and bore people. It's for them to have a good time and give back. And so Hamburger Mary's, every Wednesday, they sponsor a different nonprofit, and we're fortunate enough to be in their July slot. So it's a celebrity announcer. It's bingo. It's drinks. We've got a whole bunch of great silent auction items that I'm pulling from my entertainment background, so lots of tickets to TV shows, swag, and memorabilia, and it's a great night. I don't know if anyone's ever been out there to Hamburger Mary's. I went a few weeks ago. The line was around the block, so you definitely want to get there early, maybe around 8 or 8:30 to make sure you get in, but it's different, and it's fun, and it's a night you definitely won't remember. I mean, you will remember.
God,
you won't forget is what I meant to say. You won't forget.
That is it. I am going Hamburger Mary's in West Hollywood Drag Queen Bingo. Anybody can go, right? Or do you have to sign up on the
website? Anybody. Yeah. Anybody? And they ask for a $20 donation for your bingo card, you know, to get in the door, which is nothing. I think you get 5 bingo cards for that.
Wow.
And then after that, it's just have fun with your friends, you know,
and
help us sponsor a child.
Oh, I am going to get a little group together and we are going. I am going to.
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm going to ask Christina DeRosa if she's going, and then I'm going to ask my friend Stephen Levine of Grapevine PR. I'm going to get about 10 people to come, or maybe 20
people. Oh, that's
people.
Great.
But we're probably going to get there about 7:30, so we can definitely be in the front of the
Perfect.
Line.
Perfect. Then you can, have dinner before and then hang out with us after, yeah.
Oh, and then we'll get to meet you. We have Kelly Gonzalez. Well, Kelly, thank you so much. I want you to come back on the show so that we can find out if we met our goal, the goal. That
yes, thank you. Thank you so much for having me and letting me chat with you.
Gosh, I just loved having you on here. So that is such a worthy cause, everyone. Please, 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 even if you're a poor little actor, donate a dollar. A dollar would help. A dollar could do something
yes.
in Central Vietnam.
A dollar provides lunch for them.
A dollar would provide lunch. So go to the website now, themullikinproject.org, themullikinproject.org, and donate today. Please, please. And then I want you to join us for Drag Queen Bingo on July 17th at 9 p.m. at Hamburger Mary's in West Hollywood. I am going to be, as a matter of fact, announcing this at least once a month up until July 17th. So that is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get
a lot.
to come. And God bless you for what you do. You're such a wonderful contribution to this earth. You are an angel, I'm sure, to everyone at the foundation, the Mulligan Project. And thank you for not being caught up in the superficial, shallow world of entertainment, which it's very easy to do.
My husband does, so he takes that part for me.
Well, good. Let him keep bringing in the bacon while you let the grease absorb and grease your way to Vietnam and keep it going. You have to grease the officials to get some money in that country. My God, you know how they are in those countries. Oh, well, thank you so much, Kelly. I appreciate it. God bless you. And thank everybody.
Thank you, Priscilla, and I look forward to seeing you on July 17th.
Absolutely. The Mulligan Project, go to the website right now, mulliganproject.org. We'll see you on, oh my gosh, we'll see you on for Drag Queen Bingo on July 17th at 9 p.m. at Hamburger Mary's in West Hollywood. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.